Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Or when parents are like, now you should apply to Saturday Night Live.
Oh my
That's
God.
That's the classic. Yep.
Your skits are so funny. If they say skit, they don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sweet. It's well-intentioned. You know, they mean well, but not quite how it works.
Yeah, you just don't show up at those SNL auditions.
Right. And they're like, oh, you're here to be a writer? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, oh, you know, we only had a couple people show up for this.
Yeah, sit on down. This.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm ducking out, you're ducking out. Let's duck out together, see what it's all about.
Ducking out, ducking out, ducking out, ducking out.
Hi, and welcome to Diking Out, a podcast that's basically a never-ending clown car of queer women. I'm Carolyn Bergier.
I'm Sarah York.
And today we're diking out again with comedian and TV writer Lauren Ashley Smith about interracial relationships. Lauren was the head writer of The Rundown with Robin Thede and also wrote and produced segments for shows like Best Week Ever, Fashion Queens, and Watch What Happens Live with Andy Cohen. Was that super fun?
The funnest.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And my sister worked on the show, too, so that was fun.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Cool. I didn't know that your sister also is showbiz.
She is. Yeah. We've worked on 4 shows together. And
oh, my God.
She's retired from television. Now she writes mostly for, like, print, online and print. Like, she is a freelance writer.
What a dream team.
But she is, like, a very experienced, like, producer and researcher.
Cool.
That's so cool. Last night, Cecilia and I went to a double Dyke movie feature. We saw Lizzie, and then we saw Colette.
What? You saw both of those?
Both of those back-to-back.
So that's too intense.
Right? We saw Lizzie, and we got out, and I was like, do you want to just see Colette now, too?
Oh, I thought you meant, like, it was a literal double feature.
No.
What theater would have been putting that amazing?
Right? Like- right? It was at the Angelica Theater.
Oh, okay.
As I predicted, the audience for Lizzie was just lesbians and old men. I feel like anytime I go to a lesbian movie, it's just lesbians and old men or like old couples and nothing in between.
That's the kind of movie my mom and her husband would see, not realizing that it was like totally overt queer themes and be like, oh, this is interesting. You know, like they wouldn't pick that up in the trailer
at all.
Yeah.
Let me just say, what a time
was
to
Lizzie
be alive.
Good?
Both movies were great. Colette turned out to be way gayer.
Mm-hmm.
Karina, I know you saw Lizzie. Have you seen Colette? Oh, my God.
Colette's the one with Keira Knightley, right?
Yes.
Oh, she is.
And I didn't know. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know as much about, because it's based on the true story of the French author. She wrote Gigi and like a whole slew of things, and is like France's biggest female literary person of all time. And she was so like queer and just had these affairs with women, and one woman that she had like a long affair with and lived with for a while after her and her husband separated was this very butch woman who was like a marquise, and at the time it was like this big scandal, and to see that portrayal in a movie too of a butch character and the way that they talk about it, it was crazy. It was so good. And I had no idea that it was actually, because in the trailer they allude to it like a little bit, but it could also, it also made it look like maybe there's just like one or two short scenes and there's not going to be much to it, but it was like, no, a big theme of this movie is
cool.
These affairs that she has with women and her interest in women and being like dressing more masculine and things like that.
Yeah.
Which was cool. So it was a great movie. And then afterwards, we didn't realize it, there was a Q&A with the producers of the film. So it was
awesome.
So random. Yeah. And the producers are the same producers who also did Carol and Boys Don't Cry and then a bunch of movies that aren't as gay, so I'm not going to...
They don't deserve mentioning.
Yeah, we're just not going to talk about it.
How was Lizzie? Was it really... Was it, like, scary at all? Like, was it super violent, or was it more...
It was so violent at the end. It was uncomfortable the way that those people get hacked up.
Well, I mean, it's the Lizzie Borden story.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've never heard of either of these.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, well, Lizzie, so one is the Lizzie Borden story. Okay.
She's the one that
killed her parents. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But
so basically, and that's Kristen Stewart and
Chloe Sevigny.
Gotcha.
But Chloe Sevigny plays Lizzie, and Kristen Stewart plays
the Irish housemaid. Yeah.
But in the real story, like I fell into like a Wikipedia wormhole about Lizzie Borden, and she basically lived in the home with them, but then like in the ensuing investigation after, I think there was some suspicion that she was the killer, and like you never...
That she was involved because that she was nobody was ever charged.
Yeah, no one was ever, because I think they just didn't have enough evidence. And then there was this whole backstory of like this really tumultuous relationship between the daughter and the dad's wife.
Yeah.
Because of like some inheritance things, and there was some money involved. It was like a whole fucking crazy story.
Yeah. So I don't know how much. I mean, I think the part between Lizzie and the housemaid was like the most, like, you know, there's no proof that any of that happened. Kind of, but the facts of the case is like that the stepmom was killed 90 minutes before the dad was killed, so that the inheritance wouldn't have gone to the stepmom's family.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's petty.
It's like super calculating. But you go the whole movie, and then they kind of go right to, you know, the questioning and the trial, and they don't show the axe murder. So I'm like, oh, interesting. Maybe this is the take, that they're just doing Lizzie but not showing the murders. And then they show them. And spoiler alert, so I don't know, don't listen right now if you're going to see it, but they're naked when they do the murders. So it's like naked Case Stew and Chloe Sevigny. And
committing axe murder.
Committing axe murder. And it is fucking intense.
Wow.
It is intense.
That's
okay. It is.
Why?
Intense.
Is that necessary for the plot?
Yeah. Like, yeah. I'm wondering why.
I've never read anything like that. It's showing how careful they were.
So they were careful to not have bloodstained clothes.
To not have bloodstained clothes. And that, that one was supposed to murder the stepmom, and the other was supposed to murder the dad, and kind of how they both coordinated it.
Okay.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So the... But like,
but there's, I did not expect there to be that much nudity in the film, and from both of them. And
wow,
it was,
that's a real, that's a move for an actor to do a nude scene, but a nude murder scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
that's fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Is it them, or does it seem sort of like maybe body doubles?
Oh, it's
or
them.
Is it like, okay. Yeah.
It's, I mean, Chloe Sevigny,
I think she's done scenes
before. Has disrobed on screen before, but has Kristen Stewart? Not that I know
not
of.
That I,
so I was I surprised.
Think, yeah.
Because once she got naked, I was like, oh, is Kristen Stewart going to get naked too? Like, whoa, this is exciting.
That's awesome.
And yeah, both great movies, both turn of the century, like late 1800s. I don't know. It was interesting to see those movies back to back.
Yeah.
Quick PSA. There was a Q&A, like I mentioned, and Q&As where they let audiences ask questions are my least favorite things because there are always people who do not have any intention of asking a question. They
just a statement.
I just have more of a statement. Comment.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the worst.
And this one was a doozy. It was so uncomfortable. Cecilia and I were just sinking into our seats, and I was, so this woman first declares her love of the producers and how important their movies have been to her, and almost starts crying. And then
that's when I leave. That's when I get up and politely leave.
And I'm like, I could already tell there was going to be no question.
Yeah.
Then she points out a specific scene in the movie where these guys are kind of resurfacing the hardwood floors in the home. And that scene mimics an impressionist, a famous impressionist painting. So she wanted everyone to know that she knew that that was a reference to the Impressionist painting.
All right.
And then she was like, where was I going with this? Oh, I don't know. I just think it was great that you did that. I mean, did you do it on purpose? And I'm like, okay, you think they just accidentally recreated?
Right.
Like, do you understand what goes into
to do you think that me? Anything in a film is not
accidental, right?
Yeah, like, it is not a completely intentional thought about, edited, you know, like,
right. So then the producer, they were nice about it, but she corrected her and said, it's not a Degas. It's by this other impressionist. It's his name. And the,
they
left this woman with the microphone. Nobody took it away. And she goes, no, I'm pretty sure it's a Degas.
Oh my God. No.
I get
honestly so uncomfortable in any audience.
Yeah.
And, not it's performer, the worst. But like
creator.
I can't handle. I literally cannot stomach like live.
Don't
like
do
Q&A situations.
Yeah,
I can't
unless
do
you
it.
Have a question.
I skip through them on podcasts too. I can't listen to like the audience chiming in. I'm not there to hear your fucking opinions or your dumb questions. I'm there to like hear what the creator says.
Yeah, unless like ask a question that everybody wants to know the answer to.
Right.
Don't stand up just to declare
your knowledge about something.
Yeah. So then she says where she's seen the painting. She's like, but it's in the Musée d'Orsay. And I'm like, all right, lady.
All right.
Take a seat. Take a seat.
Sit down.
Right.
I would like throw a handful of popcorn. I'd be like that person.
And I didn't have to turn around to know it was a white woman. It was just like, I'm like,
that is a white lady or an any man thing.
I was like, wow. It was such a...
You would think that would be a guy that would stand up.
It was a guy move, totally. Yeah. So then I'm like, oh, I wonder if it was a lesbian, because I was like, I'm calling this out on the podcast tomorrow. And Cecilia's like, it might be a listener. I'm like, worth it.
Yeah.
She needs to know that this is not
How you Q&A. There has to be a Q.
Behavior.
And then
yes.
you have to accept the A.
Yeah.
And
relinquish the microphone.
Relinquish the mic.
And look around like, oh, who gave me this? Here, have it back.
Right,
like,
I know. I used to be the microphone runner when I volunteered at the Paley Center for media.
Okay.
And it was definitely, I would not let go of the mic. I would just hold in front of their mouth.
Yeah, that's a rookie move
and
to
you
hand
you take it.
It
back.
Yeah.
Some people will wrestle you for it.
Oh, yeah.
Because this is their moment to shine.
People would try to take it from me, and I would let them know, no, I'm holding on to this mic.
It's like handcuffed to your wrist.
Yeah,
like
I'm not
going to
let you harass
Amy
Poehler.
You have like American Ninja Warrior grip strength now. It's like, we'll not let it go.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's great. That reminds me so much of like every college class where there was always a guy with more of a comment than a question.
Yeah.
It's like, this class isn't being co-taught.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah. Well, Lauren, so I first saw you at a panel, and I was very thankful for it because they collected questions ahead of time, and
that's
the moderator
smart.
Got
and
to go through
filtered.
And select the useful ones.
That's the only way to do it.
Yes.
Why don't more players? Oh, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Have you ever had like a Q&A? I'm guessing that wasn't the only panel you've
It wasn't. Done. I have done a couple panels recently, and they've all gone pretty well. Like, I think people... are like getting hip to it, and like if you get enough people in a room that like are tired of that Musée d'Orsay person, you get people that ask good questions. I don't think I've had any really bad ones. It's just like always awkward when people are like, can you hire me? And it's like, I don't know your name.
Yeah.
My show is canceled, and I don't know what your skill set is.
Right.
So I don't know anything
about you.
And now I look like an asshole.
No, you should just be like, no.
Yeah.
No.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. I will not hire you.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah, I don't think that people realize that once you get into the industry a little bit, you should be pretty aware of it, that every person on a show has at least 100 super talented friends who, if they're going to give somebody a chance, it's them and not.
Yeah. It's going to be a known quantity.
It's someone that they've been doing comedy with
for
years
who
has... It's not just somebody that hands them a random packet or anything like that. I mean, because, you know, and even like my mom will be like, oh, well, if your friend's a writer on the Tonight Show, then why doesn't she get you a job? I'm like,
that's not how it works,
unfortunately.
At all.
Yeah.
At all.
That's great. Yeah. Even worse than the Q&As that where like someone brings the mic around the room ones where there's a microphone stand and they let people line up.
Yeah.
Oh my God. The anxiety I feel when I see a lot of people lining up is palpable. Like I want to leave the room and I want to go home because I do not wish to be there for any
at all.
It's chaos. It's anarchy. Like I can't do a Q&A structure like that.
That happened when I went to the New Yorker Festival last year and I saw Ryan Murphy and it was a line and
I can't imagine.
I think I had a valid question at the time, but then when I saw the line form, I'm like,
absolutely not.
Not getting in that mix.
Yeah.
And it definitely was a line of people that just wanted to let Ryan Murphy know how much his shows meant to them.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, oh.
There's a
podcast. Enjoyed American Horror Story?
Yeah, great. There's a podcast I really like called Bitch Sesh that has that structure at their live shows. And like sometimes it's really cool, but there are people that like, not only do they not know, like you had the survival instinct to be like, hey, actually, like I'm in a way, like is my question that important to stand in this line? Maybe not. I'm just not going to do it. The people that don't possess that quality and then also the people that torpedo their whole lives just for a chance to get on the mic. So they'll be like, because they do this thing called Boots on the Ground where they have people like talk about like interactions they've had with people on Bravo, which is like sometimes fun and whatever. But sometimes they'll be like, I work at this gym on 49th and 7th and this celebrity came in and said this personal thing about how her son has this health problem and my name is Jessica.
Oh,
and
it's like, what the fuck are you doing? Trying to get fired.
This is a live podcast. There are 200 people here. Yeah. You're an idiot.
Oh my God.
That's hilarious. Oh my God. I love that. People will just, I've been to a couple things where people, where it was sort of like, it wasn't necessarily a Q&A. It was like, tell your story about how that, and then I don't want.
That's when I go get a drink. I go to the bathroom. I catch up on emails.
I would rather do anything else than be like in a room where just random ass people are telling their story.
Yeah.
I just have such an issue with people talking who aren't the reason I'm there. Who aren't storytellers.
Right.
You know?
Oh my gosh. When I was in college, they had a debate night about gay marriage.
Oh.
And I went because...
You went to that?
Oh, I went because I wanted to hear the other side because at the time I'm like, I just don't understand. I want to hear one convincing argument that isn't just like a veil for I don't think gay people should be married because it's a sin or whatever.
Yeah.
It is like... and it was, like the slippery slope arguments and those kind of things. And they just ended up looking really stupid and nobody could build a logical or argument that made any sense. So anyway, they had a line form of people that could make points or ask either side to whatever. And I just remember this old man walked up and was like, I just don't think it's fair to those of us who can't get married because no one will marry us.
Oh my God.
And it was like, oh my God, this is.
That activates all of my anxiety triggers. Like this entire story.
And nobody knew what to say. They're like, why should gay people get rights when I don't get marriage benefits And he was just like this lonely old man that like came to this college campus debate night on gay marriage.
That's
just
brutal.
To like represent really the incels, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. It was like nobody knew what to say to that. Yeah.
I also can't do anything that involves the word debate. Like I'm not here for a debate. I feel like
that's the first and last.
Because I feel like that whole debate culture, like that debate me bullshit is small dick energy from the men who use it. And also it's kind of, to me, I'm associating it strictly with like the conservative Twitter. That's like, well, why doesn't Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez show up and debate me? Like that one asshole.
Yeah. Ben Shapiro.
Fucking Ben Shapiro. Yeah.
Blech.
It's like, well, number one, you're not running against her. Like,
why should she?
Why does she owe you her time?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, also the way that when that happened, how people could not understand when she compared it to catcalling, and they're like, he wasn't catcalling her. She needs to get over. I'm like, no, she didn't say he was catcalling. It's the sit. oh, what is wrong with you people?
Exactly. That's, and, that to me is gay and
they're,
culture.
They're
and
like, oh, she's such an idiot because she thought that was catcalling. Yeah. Nope.
The false not what she said. Thing. I hate it. Yeah.
The gaslighting. Everything.
I really shouldn't live on Twitter, but I do.
Yeah I got to log out a lot of times.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I can't. I'm not going to. It's not good for my heart. I don't want to die early because of Twitter. I don't want that.
Yeah. I'm on it so much less now.
Oh, my God.
Because I'm
all in on it. And I don't know how to, I don't know. I justify it because I don't have Facebook or Instagram. So it's like my one thing. But instead of spending a little bit of time on three apps, I spend a lot of time on one.
Exactly.
And it's not good.
Yeah. I quit Facebook and I was like, for like a year, I was like, awesome. Like that debate energy has like left my life.
Yeah.
And then slowly Instagram and Twitter just grew to expand to fill the space.
Yeah.
And now I'm getting mad about stuff on Instagram. And I was like, this isn't where I want to be.
Yeah.
This isn't where I want to be emotionally.
Ugh. I know. Twitter is like, it's like a gas in a room. It just expands to fill the room.
Totally.
And that's like what it's done in my life. It's brought some good things, but it's also like, all right. I just find myself getting so bogged down and so mad that I should be able to say like, oh, I'll just put my phone down and not be on it.
Yeah.
But I still do it.
Yeah.
So there is no solution.
I just have a do not engage. I don't let myself engage with trolls.
Oh, I don't engage.
Because I did engage for a while.
What's your policy on engaging with people?
It depends. But my main issue in life and also on the internet is like, I can't let stuff go. Like if I know I'm right.
Yeah.
I can't like be the bigger person or like be like,
the internet's a really healthy place for you.
Exactly. So I have to like make the quick decision right at the outset. Because if I engage once, then there's no coming back from that. Like I can't opt out halfway through. It's either 0 to 100. So I try to remain at 0. And sometimes like I truly can't. And then I go off and then I'm like, oh, why did I do that? But usually it's do not engage.
Okay. Yeah. That's kind of mine too. Unless it's like someone comments on something literally to me. Like if I get added from someone, then I feel like I kind of have to.
Yeah.
But that's fairly rare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other good thing about Twitter too that stops me is like usually when I get mad, what I'll do to stop myself is I'll look at the replies and I'm like, someone else did it for me.
Someone always beat you to it.
And so I'm like, I don't need, I'm all set.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of what I figure. I'm like, other people are handling it.
There are some people who, like some really high profile people whose entire Twitter presence is basically just engaging.
Yeah.
Like,
and I don't like that to me just requires the kind of mental and emotional energy that I don't think I can possibly possess. Yeah. Like some of the shit that like Roxane Gay gets on Twitter.
Oh my God.
How has she not burned it all down?
I would have punched through a wall I hope she has a room in her house that's just like
just holes.
Punching through.
Yeah.
It's just like, she's just
glass
like,
bottles.
Yeah.
And someone comes over every week to like spackle it
up.
Yeah,
she's
like,
got demo room.
Rough
yeah.
week, huh, Roxane? As they're like fixing up the walls. I don't know how she. I think people in her position, I'm sure, have a self care routine that like pulls them out of social media. I don't know, but it just some people are really getting stuff. And like former guest Talia Levin, engages a lot, and I don't know how she does it. But it like gives me the chills thinking about having to deal with that kind of bullshit on Twitter.
So on that note, let's talk about interracial dating slash relationships. All right.
Yeah. Let's segue right into that.
Yeah. Pros, cons. That's really what I have written on my notes. Pros, cons.
So I guess like everyone's background as far as relationships, like you're married.
Mm-hmm.
Is your wife, she's Jewish?
She's white. Yeah. Right. She's
okay,
Jewish.
Cool. Yeah. Have you dated people from kind of all backgrounds before?
Like a big dater. Like I had not dated a ton of people. Mostly I would say people of color before her. Like I had a couple of like intercultural, like all of my relationships have been like intercultural. Like the first girl I dated was from Trinidad. So like she was a citizen of Trinidad, like non-American. And so that was like different, but she was black.
Yeah.
Like I am. And so there were certain things that like I didn't really understand about her. She didn't understand about me. And then like I've been with my wife for like almost 9 years. So
oh, okay.
I've not, my memory of other people has completely gone away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, we're like as culturally, racially, class, everything different you could possibly imagine.
Yeah.
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 And what are some of the challenges do you think that that kind of brings to a relationship?
I would say I don't think there are a ton of challenges at this juncture, but it is interesting because she is in a lot of ways culturally Black, like not the way that she grew up, but like she has a very deep understanding of Black culture. Like when mm-hmm. I met her, she was working at BET. So like okay. she's logged a lot of hours like yeah. with Black people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So like the first night that I spent the night at her house, she like had like a silk scarf for me to wrap my hair,
oh,
which was
oh.
like, I was like, what the heck? This is so
yeah.
crazy.
Yeah.
So like she just like intimately knows Black people and has since she, cause she went to boarding school and a lot of her friends at boarding school were Black. So she's like, I'm not the first Black person that she has like lived around,
which yeah.
is important to me. Cause I
That's
feel like
good.
As much as like woke is like, you can be as a white person or as like allied you can be, there is a certain level of proximity that, most white people will never attain mm-hmm. to Black
yeah.
people. Like you can have a Black coworker or a Black close friend or even a best friend.
Yeah.
But unless like you're related to somebody, like she worked in a culturally Black workplace.
Yeah.
So there were just things that she like, you know, incidental learning that I think that she had logged a lot of that time before I even got to her.
Yeah.
So, the way that we talk, like I asked her the other night, like because I code switch usually, like when I talk, the way I talk to my family is like probably a little bit different than the way I'm talking to you guys.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And but the way that I talk to my wife is the way I talk to my family. Like I call her the N-word all the time. And I was trying to ask her, I was like, do you remember like when I started talking to you like someone that I knew intimately and not yeah. some like not just like a random white person? Like she couldn't remember.
Yeah.
Cause I like said something like somebody was tripping or something. And like, that's not something I would say to like
yeah.
one of my white friends.
Yeah.
But like I say that to her cause like we speak the same language.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really good point you bring up. Like the difference between for white women or white people who, mm-hmm. Might think that they're woke to a level,
yeah.
but there's always like so much that you don't know it. So I feel like a lot of us are raised, where I was mm-hmm. raised, I was raised outside of Buffalo for the most part. And you're taught that, oh, everybody's the same.
Which is the opposite of what?
Correct.
Yeah. And that's not so.
And that's like the good. That's the good
intention
yeah.
to have is like, saying that everybody is
yeah.
is the same, and what they should specify is that like we're all like everybody should be worthy at like a human mm-hmm. level and treated with the same amount of respect and dignity and those kind of things the same,
mm-hmm.
but. No,
but what
like,
everyone,
there are
we're
differences.
All one is just erasure of like
exactly. exact
backgrounds.
And it makes it sound
yeah.
like differences aren't good.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
there are so many differences, and you learn that, you know, as mm-hmm. you go through your life. And I remember when I was living in Atlanta, and that was the first time that, you know, I was usually one of the few white people
mm-hmm.
In the spaces I was in. And it was a huge learning curve for me. And also like a big, like learning about never having to see myself as how other people see white people.
Mm-hmm.
Like for one, I didn't know how nosy we are.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, we're the worst.
Oh, they were like, finally someone was just like, why would you say that? Or why would you ask that? I'm like, I don't know. They're like, that's not a question you ask someone. I was like, it's not.
Yeah.
They're like, you are so nosy. I'm like, but all the white people I know do yeah. this. You know?
Yeah.
So yeah.
There's a lot of unlearning that has to happen as
yeah.
we, like, I feel like, well, I think that white people who self-identify as woke are often
that's a
not
problem.
Like
yeah.
those are the ones that I'm like, oh, my radar, like I clock those people. I'm like, I'm going to keep an eye on you because I think you're going to say something fucked up
yeah.
pretty
yeah.
soon.
Yeah.
And it almost always happens. But yeah, like the whole cultural proximity versus consuming Black culture are completely different
totally
things.
Totally different.
You know?
Yes.
And I think that's the I think that's where people, white people who self-identify as woke, are doing it because they've consumed a lot of black culture, but they are not in cultural proximity, mm-hmm. which I yeah. think is a are two distinctions that white people have a problem making.
Yeah, and like one thing I'm very attuned to is like on social media or like just in life, like I'll be like, oh, okay, like I have friends that I know that I would consider a friend and I'm sure they would consider me a friend. But then I look at like their vacation pictures or their birthday parties or their weddings, like most important things to them. And yeah. it's an all white space.
Yeah.
And I'm
yep.
like, that to me is a red flag mm-hmm. because even the like the biggest allies are like still operating in supremely white spaces.
Yeah.
That's number one. And then number two, which is sort of similar to what you were saying, Sarah, is that like people who are woke a lot of times or like feel like they have like this entree into black culture, it's usually based on like interactions with like one or two or three black people.
Yeah. yeah.
And one thing that I find very comforting and secure about being around my wife is that her knowledge of black culture is not built around just me. Like she yeah. isn't like, oh, black, all black people must do this thing because Lauren does this thing. Cause she has hundreds of, you know, and thousands of black interactions to
yeah.
build things off of. Like, I wouldn't ever assume that what you do is something that all white people did
uh-huh. yeah.
because I live in a world that is white. So like, I understand that like white people are different and have nuances and like some things are similar and some things are not.
Yeah.
And I think that the pitfall that some people fall into, white people fall into, is like, oh, well, my like black step cousin really likes Drake. So like Drake must be super popular. It's like mm-hmm. Drake is popular, but it's not like a black thing or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that proximity is what helps people build like a full understanding that like, oh, like people are different.
Yeah. yeah.
and, you know, this, I'm basing this on a lot more data, let's say, than just like a couple people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. That's kind of like the BuzzFeed effect of like consuming parts of a culture and then not considering everything else. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like BuzzFeed has this way. I bring that up often because I have kind of a problem with the way that they tend to, first of all, they tend to post like tweets and things by people and then not give them any credit for it.
Yeah.
Like they kind of take elements of black culture, like language and like trends and things that are cool and like, and then turn around and use that language to be like cool. You know what I mean? Like they'll say like, it's lit. And you look at it, it's a fucking white girl that wrote the article or like that
or,
kind of
or
thing.
The
I don't know. It's like
the GIF reactions.
Yeah. Yes, GIF reactions.
Like it's digital blackface.
Yes.
Digital blackface.
Yeah. I think that that's something that that's should be addressed amongst the white people of Twitter.
Like, yeah. PSA listeners.
Yeah.
If you find yourself only posting GIFs of black women and black men mm-hmm. reacting to things, there's, I forgot where, there was an article
that came
out.
Teen Vogue, I think.
Teen Vogue, yeah. It had mm-hmm. a great piece about digital blackface. And
Teen Vogue is doing some of the best work right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I think that that's something that's interesting and that should be kind of drilled down on because yeah, I just think you can be a courteous cultural guest without having to like co-opt everything and spit it back out as your own. I don't know.
And also it's not like it's coming from a place of like I own this and you can't participate because it's not fair. The place that I'm coming from, and I think that like the real critique people have with cultural appropriation in those instances is like, I have a huge problem with people using African American vernacular English, AKA Ebonics, mm-hmm. and like Instagram captions and stuff, because I don't care that you use AABE. I do care if you use it incorrectly because you don't understand that it has a grammatical structure to it because it's like a lesser dialect. And I also have an issue with it because it's like, okay, if I do like, let's say I'm Native American and I have a Native American name and all these like cultural things that mean a lot to me that have negatively affected my ability to get jobs mm-hmm. or assimilate into like mainstream culture. And like, if I use African American vernacular English in an email, I'm not going to get a job interview. So it's like, you don't get to use things that in white society work to my disadvantage.
Yeah.
Yes.
That is the main thing.
Yes.
It's not like you just don't get to use it because you're not cool. It's because like if you do like, you know, if you say it, it's cool. But if I do it, it makes me lose money and standing
and
social access.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is the issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
I think I'm sure that that's always, I know that's always been a thing of white people being like, well, why can't I say it? But like the internet really brings it out, and it's so clearly illustrated now, especially like certain things that trend on Twitter. Like remember when Thanksgiving with Black families trended on Twitter, and all I saw were like white people stepping in, first of all, feigning offense to the whole like season your food thing, and they're like, well, what do you mean we don't season our food? It's like, can you shut the fuck? Can you fucking stop? Can just, you just like not involve yourself? Like, it's so it's infuriating, and it's interesting too because it's always, it's almost always like a well-intended white girl who has kind of one of those not all white people things to say, and it's like, I, you're not helping. Yeah. You are literally illustrating the point here. I don't know. I just, I get a lot of internet. I get really angry on the internet at specific instances like that of white, of always, usually white women stepping in with like their two cents, or like, it's a very, it's a thing that I've noticed on social media, specifically Twitter, where it's like, there's this phenomenon, I think, where white women simply have to be involved in something. Is that a thing? Like, is that like, am I imagining that? But I really feel like, totally. I'm like, okay, why? It's like they just, they have to step in and like take a little bit of something, or like, why can't I be involved? Why am I not invited? It's like, it's not, it just, you don't, not everything is for you. Well, not that, everything is to be consumed by you.
When Beyonce came out with Formation, and a lot of white women were like, and it's like, well, no, this isn't for you.
Yeah. And I thought Saturday Night Live did a great, oh my God,
that was perfect. This is a great sketch.
Yeah, that was a good sketch. But yeah, that's kind of like, that's something that I've noticed that I think has been amplified by Twitter and by social media.
So bringing that back to relationships, and obviously me not being a black woman, but I feel like when it comes to interracial relationships, I don't know, I would imagine that sometime, or that most of the time, obviously the burden is on the person of color, of maybe dealing with white person bullshit. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I was talking to my wife a little bit about it, like coming into this episode, and I'm like, how much white person bullshit do you put up with from me? And she's like, oh, not a lot. And I'm like, okay.
She's very sweet.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she's like, I can't think of anything, but I'm like, I know it's got to be there. But there are some things like my family is great. My dad makes inappropriate jokes, like once referred to her as a migrant worker.
Ooh,
when she was babysitting my nephews.
No,
he made a joke about migrant labor being cheaper. And actually my mom got very upset about that, and she's like, that's not funny.
We should give her some background on your parents. They're not together, but they are.
Yeah.
And her dad's French.
My dad's French, and he thinks he's hilarious and makes a lot of inappropriate white old man jokes. And I do not find any of them funny. And but stuff like that. And, you know, Cecilia will laugh it off in the moment, but then afterwards I circle back with her. I mean, I call it out, and then I apologize and say, you know, obviously that wasn't cool. I'm sorry that made you feel anything. And she'll be like, yeah, that did make me a little bit uncomfortable. That wasn't, you know, that, but I know he likes me, loves me, doesn't mean bad. I'm like, that doesn't make it okay. You know, whereas like there's not really any equivalent to that I, you know, that I'm getting from her family. There's no weird, awkward moments for, like, I never have to feel awkward for being white in relationship.
Well, yeah, but that's, I mean, that's kind of, I think, baked into white privilege in general. It's that,
I know.
Like, every space that we go in, by default, we are granted access in a way, or
it's like specific privileges. You can be privileges. At a restaurant that's like with 24 of her relatives, but like the world you're still living in is a white world, and it's like a white space, so it's like not, the stakes are lower.
Yeah
Like when we went to go watch the World Cup, Peru and the World Cup, and we went to this Peruvian restaurant, and I was literally like the only white person there, and everyone was Peruvian, but there wasn't anything that, you know,
but we don't feel
that was
we by virtue of white privilege don't have to feel that sense of anxiety of like being the only person in the room, like,
yeah,
you know, it's just not, it's not something that we deal with. And it's interesting watching white people grapple with that and not be able to accept it. Cause like we can't accept, you know, it's interesting to watch people struggle with just simply acknowledging privilege. Cause it's just not,
yeah,
it's not something that we're ever really confronted with.
Yeah.
And especially when we, like, I come from the Midwest, I grew up in Nebraska, and everyone that I grew up with chose, you know, has stayed for the most part, stayed there in that kind of insular, you know, that insular world where white supremacy is not something that they think about, which is a symptom of white supremacy. It's like, yeah, it circles back, and they don't even realize, yeah, they're proving my point when they say things like, well, I don't see color. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
Yes, you do.
Right. Or they, you know, start to equate their own personal problems as a lack of privilege, mm-hmm, without acknowledging that privilege is benefiting from institutions and structures and, yes, laws and,
yeah,
systems,
yeah,
that are irrelevant and unrelated to your personal struggles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So like I can be having a bad day, but I can still operate from a place of being privileged as a cisgender person, or,
right,
from class privilege, or from educational privilege, even if I personally am like, oh, I got a C today. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
That is the hard negotiation to make with people that aren't able to,
yeah,
share.
And that's definitely a hard one for straight cis people to, you know, like when I have to kind of explain a little bit to my straight friends that, you know, one of the reasons I don't go home often is because I get this very palpable, like, someone's kind of standing on my chest when I'm in the Midwest, because, mm-hmm, I present as a very masculine, butch, like, dykey woman.
Yeah.
And there are no fucking gay people there. So it's like,
yeah,
me, I stick out like a sore thumb, and I get the weird looks, and public restrooms are a thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I've literally been shouted at by women in, yeah, restrooms. They're like, this is a ladies' room. And then they realize, and I'm usually very, so I find myself using this different.
And then you flash your boobs.
I mean, I have fucking D boobs. Like, I think I present as a cisgender woman, but, yeah, to people in the Midwest who don't ever
see any kind of anything,
I'm like
that's
a fucking freak to them.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't see anything that's not. So I do find myself as a defense mechanism, in a restroom, if I say like, oh, excuse me, or whatever, I use a sort of a little bit more of a feminine voice that I reserve for spaces where I'm like, I need to make it known in some way that I'm a woman, because then it's going to be a thing.
You
for
just
even
turn
for
up
a
the
moment.
Vocal fry.
I actually have a little bit of a vocal. It's like, it's not really vocal fry, but it's like a slightly yeah, more feminine. I don't know if that's an octave or whatever the word would be for that. But yeah, yeah, it's sort of a weird defense thing that I have to kick on. And then, but yeah, like that's something that's hard to explain to like heteronormative cis presenting women, particularly, that I can't just like slide into any space without expecting a little bit of reaction,
totally,
in certain,
yeah,
parts of the country. And even it's happened here too. I mean, a little bit.
Yeah.
Kind of depends.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm. Are you ready to shop? Rakuten's Big Give Week is back. Get 15% back at hundreds of stores, and it's all happening this week, May 6th to May 13th. It's the perfect time to shop for everything on your list for spring and summer, like clothing, outdoor gear, and travel. I know I'm using this week to stock up on some warmer weather essentials at Ray-Ban and Ulta, and I love that Rakuten even helps me save on travel at sites like hotels.com. Rakuten really is the best way to shop, and you can save even more by stacking cash back on top of deals. Plus, during Big Give Week, that cash back is bigger than ever. With Rakuten, membership is free, and when you sign up and shop today, you get an extra 10% cash back boost. That's an extra 10% cash back on top of the 15% cash back. You won't see higher cash back rates than these. Go to Rakuten.com or download the Rakuten app. R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Shoppers get it.
I was thinking about in New York, and I don't know if this is a product of being in New York, but I feel like I know more interracial queer couples mm-hmm. than I do straight couples. And I looked into it, and actually, based on the 2010 census, UCLA analyzed it that same-sex couples, 20.6% couples were interracial or interethnic, compared to 18.3% of straight unmarried couples and 9.5% of straight married couples.
Oh, okay.
That is, yeah, that makes sense. That is a thing.
Yeah. But I was like, I didn't know if it was really a thing or it was just me living in New York, but I feel like so many of the queer couples I know, like half of them are.
Yeah.
An interracial.
Here's my explanation for that. I think it's because if you're queer, you're already operating outside of the like normal structure, mm-hmm. like escalator of sure. like relationships.
Yeah.
So if you're already like left of center as far as like being attracted to someone that isn't the heteronormative gender identity, then it's not so far of a leap to be like, also this person is culturally different from me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That is my way of explaining it. But that also shocks me in a lot of ways because I find gay spaces to be some of the most segregated and racially separated and often racist spaces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially like for men, like on Grindr with like no
white
Asians,
gay men, are.
No blacks, no fats, no whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I my sister is in an interracial gay relationship as well. I'm trying to think of any. I know a couple, and I think it's changing too. But I do find that interesting because back when I was single and dating, like I would never expect that like a white woman would ever hit on me like at Stonewall or anything like that.
Yeah.
Like that just was not ever gonna happen.
Even bisexual, queer black women I know mm-hmm. when they date men, they date white men.
Okay.
And I always thought that
I have actually, I've got a few friends that have dated white men that don't. Yeah, I've definitely seen that. The issue of racism within the gay male community is something that I had fucking no idea about until seeing some
screenshots. I learned that when I lived in Atlanta.
Grindr profile, like Grindr, for some reason is like a very, it's a kind of a destructive place to be.
Yeah,
and I frankly I don't have a lot of gay male friends. I have a few, but I never quite realized how kind of just out there the racism and kind of body shaming a little bit that happens mm-hmm. in that community.
Sure.
Kind of like, I kind of like that sort of tracks with me. Like, you know, gay men tend to be a little bit more on the sort of, they're visual creatures, you know, but it's like, that's definitely an issue that I think doesn't get explored within because, you know, I think that the lens of gay rights is often and stories about gay struggles over the years are always told through the lens of white men.
Yeah.
And I would be interested to kind of drill down more of like interracial relationships within that community and how maybe the numbers might differ in women or you know, feminine presenting people.
So when I lived in Atlanta, I was surprised. I didn't know or expect how segregated the city was going to be, that it was way more, you know, in New York, it's a lot more integrated than mm-hmm. most cities. Tampa in Atlanta, you would go to some places and it would either be 95% black or 95% white. Mm-hmm. And other than the workplace was one of the most integrated places, thankfully, that, mm-hmm. you know, but gay bars were the only bars that I would go to where I would see people from different backgrounds, different cultures, yeah. different races mixed together. So I always kind of thought that the gay community was a lot more inclusive overall. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that it was just because there are limited gay bars. Yeah. So we're all together. But within the gay bar, there's some stuff going on that's not... Yeah. Cool.
Like there's this party I used to go to every once in a while, a girl party here in New York called Truck Stop, where it was like, it was so fun.
That's but a cool
it was
name.
Like, I haven't heard about that, but I'm like, ooh.
They would have these like, it had the thing that I liked about it, which in hindsight is probably bad. It had all the trappings of like a very heteronormative, like it was like if you went to like a bar where you could get bottle service and all this stuff, but it was like all lesbians.
Oh, wow.
But, and it was like so fun and the crowd was very diverse, but all the like go-go dancers and like cocktail waitresses and stuff, like the hot women that were like there, they'd like dance on the tables and stuff. They were all white, all very femme, almost like very like you were, they were not like clockable as gay women. And I don't think that they were, but like they were all white women. And I was like, that is indicative of the like erasure and also very white centered, gaze of the lesbian community.
Yeah.
At the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's I could see that happening. Yeah. Maybe it was a situation where it's like, these are the girls that work at this club, you know, or like
it's
whatever.
It's possible.
Yeah. But still that's very telling.
And it's
in
like
that kind of space.
Even like every pride, like I don't really go to the Dyke March because I'm like, eh, but I do go to Color Me Queer, which is like run by like the Desi gays, but it's like we're all the like black, brown, Asian, everybody, queers sort of gather because that weekend is still so largely like really white,
really
oriented.
White, and I think really male too. Like I kind of feel like pride is like.
Well, that's why I like I went to the Dyke March for the first time this year and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Just because it was, I mean, it was kind of everyone representing every, like, Abolish ICE was the biggest theme at the Dyke March this year. So it was cool to see that. And then to also, I mean, there were some men and also trans men at the Dyke March, which was good. But a lot of them were also like on the sidewalks with signs of support. And that was also cool
That's
to
awesome.
See because you usually don't see. And very few. But there were a few gay men that were there with signs on the sidewalk supporting the Dyke March. Mm-hmm. And it kind of made me realize how little of that there is of that.
You were talking about Atlanta. I went to Chicago a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And for the population of Chicago is like 32% black.
Yeah.
And I found myself in Chicago thinking like this is the most fucking segregated city I've ever been in because I would look around and it was, I'm telling you, 100% white in like restaurants and bars and like entire neighborhoods. And I found myself really uncomfortable there because it's like, it's uncomfortable to me to be in a space that is that like
that's how
homogenous
Boston is
in
too.
One. Yeah. It's like, how is this possible that these cities have just like, or these pockets of these cities are so intentionally, I think intentionally, so fucking white. And I'm like,
So those are probably cities for, that would make interracial dating harder.
Right. I'm sure. Like, I can't imagine. Because it's just like so, it's so glaringly obvious outside of New York how this all tends to work.
I would say, I mean, also being in New York, the fact that there are like a lot of Peruvian restaurants and that, you know, because Cecilia was the first Peruvian woman that I'd ever been with.
Mm-hmm.
So she kind of introduced me to all that. But if we lived in, you know, Buffalo, it wouldn't be the case. And she wouldn't be able to kind of share that part of her life with me, which like, one, Peruvian food is amazing, and I can't believe I'd gone my whole life not eating it. But I mean, I love that part of her so much, And I love that she speaks Spanish. And an interesting thing was that her ex did not like when she spoke Spanish in the house.
Kind of shitty.
Yeah.
What?
And would get annoyed and would also be annoyed. So when I asked her about the white bullshit question, mm-hmm. she was like, honestly, like compared to my last relationship where I just felt like whenever my Latinness came out that I was being judged for it. So when she would get like excited and loud or whatever, that her, mm-hmm. her ex would be like, don't do that. Or, and when she would talk Spanish, she would get annoyed. I'm like, I love it when you
speak Spanish.
Yeah, yeah. And when I hear you talk to your family on the phone and you, you know, aww. Talk to them the way you talk to them. It's great. Like you light up in a different way, and that's like such a part of yeah. who you are. And I love to see that and be exposed to that.
Yeah.
And
did you and your wife yeah. meet in New York?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where is she from?
She's from New York.
Okay.
And so she grew up mostly between here and Connecticut.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like that's probably a crucial component of, you know, I don't know. I feel like someone from New York, people from New York are just like different. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
it's something that I noticed when I moved here, because I moved here from a extremely white, like pretty conservative, not necessarily a conservative family, but yeah, it's like people that grow up here are just yeah. so much like more able to culturally kind of like get it.
And even if you don't interact, like even if your social circle, your family circle is still largely like white or whatever mm-hmm. ethnic or racial background you have in New York, you can't walk out the door without interacting with mm-hmm. like somebody that's different or even being sure. just around them. So like
yeah.
the way that there are still racists in New York, there are still bigots yeah. in New York, there's still all those things, but there is something different in the way that those racists and bigots have that bigotry because of the... They can't isolate themselves
yeah.
from
yeah.
different people. So, like, I notice when I go home to St. Louis, if I walk into, like, a restaurant, which is also very segregated, if I walk into a restaurant that's, like, mostly white people with, like, my mom and my sisters, I can tell that the way that white people look at black people in St. Louis is different than the way that white people in New York or New Jersey look at black people.
Oh, yeah.
Because they've just seen more. Even yeah. if they've never right. spoken to one,
yeah.
they are used to seeing me in the wild.
Yeah.
Whereas in certain places in St. Louis, like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
they found us, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
Because they don't have to ride the subway with people that look different than
right.
them. They don't have to
Karina
go to school
just
with
spent the summer in the Midwest,
them.
So yeah. it feels like she's had a...
It's really, yeah. it really yeah. is. I'm like, I can see in their eyes ugh. The way that they are looking at me differently. It's either a place of like supreme, like white paternalistic pity or fear or just surprise or mm-hmm. whatever.
Yeah.
But that is not in the faces of the people that live here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's how, really
how
interesting.
How are you and your wife kind of received publicly in St. Louis versus... Or even Connecticut, I guess, you know, like
it's well
is,
in
is Connecticut,
Connecticut
like conservative. No, that's like yes, liberal.
It's pretty liberal, but like she lives in a very,
but it's conservative, small,
it's liberal, white,
like,
right?
Yeah. She lives in like a very rural, like wealthy area.
Okay.
So like,
yeah.
when I am in the town, I'm like, I know that I and my father-in-law's like home health aide, who's Jamaican. I'm like, all the black people in this town are in this house.
Yeah.
I know that with certainty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like in, I would say the most like, outward reactions we've gotten from people have happened in New York. Like one time we're on the bus on the Upper East Side and like, I think I just like laid my head on her shoulder and this like old white woman behind us was like, if you're trying to shock people, it's not working. And I was like, well, number one, obviously
what?
It is, number
the
two,
Upper East Side.
No, so
oh,
I,
there's
I
some
don't
racist
think
old
I've,
ladies on the Upper East Side.
Yeah. I don't think I've in. Oh really experienced that. She's come to St. Louis a couple times.
Yeah.
But, and also we both present as straight. So it's like kind of a tough sell. Like we could be like full on making out and people would still be like, I think they're best friends. Like
yeah.
people, it's really hard for people yeah. to understand
yeah.
and accept that we are a couple.
Oh yeah.
Because they have these layers to get
has
through.
To, like their brain tries to dodge it.
Yeah.
You don't get the fashion. Sisters thing.
No, because we're different.
Yeah.
So,
right.
we
so then you're best friends.
Best
yeah.
roommates. Like,
It's funny, like, the mental gymnastics people have to go through.
They'll go out of their way.
Yeah.
And, like, that's why it was really tough for me being engaged, because fiancé is such an ambiguous word. That's mm-hmm. why I love
oh,
saying my
yeah,
wife.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Even then, like, people are like, oh, you know, like, your wife. Like, you know, when people are being married on Facebook to, like, their sorority
oh my
sisters.
God.
Like, it just, like, it really
yeah.
is, I have
people?
To pitch my marriage
right.
to people.
Multiple
you're selling
times.
It all the
yes.
time.
Multiple
yeah.
times I've been asked if I live with my wife. It happened again at the wedding.
He's like, oh, you live together?
They're
yes,
like,
yes, we're spouses.
We're married.
I had been talking about my wife all weekend, and this guy who was like really cool and, you know, like raised by artists in upstate New York.
Right.
He said, oh, so do you live with your partner? I'm like, my wife.
Yeah. Yes, yes. We share a residence. Yes.
We live together.
We live together.
Yeah.
That's a thing.
Because no one
it's
would
so
ever ask
bizarre.
A woman and a man that.
No.
Ever.
No.
Oh my God. That's so funny.
It's so weird.
Yeah. Yeah. The sisters thing, the best friend thing is like, it's like they get through these levels
mm-hmm. yeah.
before they actually, they realize and uh-huh. you can see like the smoke coming out of their brains.
Yes,
like,
yeah.
But yeah, that I imagine would be having the added layer of like an interracial present, like yeah. to present yeah. people with an interracial couple is just so like, yeah. Ugh. Yeah.
We get hit on together like sometimes by like
really?
Dudes. And so like two dudes will come up and start talking to us and like, yeah. we'll just be nice, like, or yeah. whatever. And then they'll say, how do you guys know each other? And we'll say, we're married. And then they disappear. The yeah.
They just disintegrate.
They're just like, no.
They literally melt, and all you have is a pile of their clothes.
Like trousers yeah. of like yeah. a blazer, like, a sport yeah. coat.
Some seersucker.
There's a plaid shirt.
Yeah.
Some Vans.
And like an Android phone and yeah. just like drops to the ground.
Oh my God. That's incredible. Oh my God. I love that.
So one thing I didn't ever think about too much, except Keisha Zoller is a hilarious, talented comedian.
She's great.
And she was in a serious, very serious medical situation.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband is white. And the doctors would not listen to her. And it was like a life Ugh. Or death situation.
Yeah.
And she had to tell her husband, like, you use your white man privilege and mm-hmm. you tell these doctors that they need to operate on me right now. Something's
yeah.
wrong. And, that's when they decided to take her seriously the whole time. And I wonder, like, I don't know, like, it was just something I never thought about. And yeah.
Well, wielding privilege to help someone else is often, like, sometimes yeah. that is necessary. And I can't believe, because that reminds me of like the Serena Williams story about how that's like even a wildly wealthy, mm-hmm. famous black woman.
It truly doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
living in a black body, like I can tell when somebody just doesn't see me as a person. Like people literally don't see me. And like to the point that like they'll walk into me or like my yeah. wife even pointed out to me once, like I've thankfully not had that because I remember when that happened to Keisha. I haven't had it in that dire of a circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
like, at number one, I just don't hail cabs anymore. If I'm with my wife, she knows she gets the cab. I'm
yeah,
not doing
yeah, yeah,
it
because yeah.
they're not going to stop for me.
Yep.
If I go to a bar, my wife noticed like a couple years into us dating, she'd be like, oh, I'll just go get our drinks because they ignore me for much longer. Like the bartender will go around, like do a loop and just never acknowledge or yeah. ask me anything.
Yeah.
And she's seen that happen so many times that I didn't even know it was happening. She clocked it happening.
Yeah.
Because she was like, that never happens to me.
Have you found that she often will identify things like that? Like, or are you like, or is it kind of even of like you sort of knowing?
It's pretty even. And I think we have like a shorthand. Like we now know like what, like I know like she doesn't like talking on the phone. So like I'll order food for us. But
yeah.
if it's like a front facing thing where like white privilege, like if it's a restaurant and it's like me, her and my sisters going to brunch, she'll go in and ask for a table because we're gonna get a table quicker than if I go in or my sisters go in.
Yeah.
yeah.
And so it's, but it's like not even a discussion anymore. It's just like,
okay.
oh, you did. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that was my other question. Very, if you acknowledge it verbally or if it's just kind of like, we know.
Yeah. It's like the same. It's just, you know.
Yeah.
You just know.
Yeah. I mean, Cecilia, like, looks a little bit more European. Like, she's mm-hmm. Peruvian, but half of her family is of European descent. So we don't have anything, like, that's that mm-hmm. pronounced of a difference in terms of, like, how people treat us.
And how she can kind of present.
Yeah. So she does have that privilege that she doesn't present necessarily as, like, overtly South American.
Latin, yeah.
But there are situations like going to political protests and stuff like that where sometimes I'm like, you need to be very careful.
Yes.
And interactions because like you can't get arrested because you're applying for a green card
mm-hmm.
and you can also be detained and people are going to target you mm-hmm. and think that you're a troublemaker more than
they would you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's another thing I wish that white people understood, especially in the hashtag resist era, is that our privilege can be wielded in such a useful way, because there's also a big difference in how much trouble we're allowed to get into.
Totally.
And how much trouble we're allowed to create.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like I can say, I could probably tell a cop to fuck off.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
some cases. And I maybe would never. Never. Like, and that's like,
yeah.
that is such a palpable, like serious element of privilege. And I would be interested to see how that, or to hear from you, how that factors into your relationship as far as like, if you're in public and something fucked up happens, or, you know, or they're just like, you know, someone's, you have like a customer service issue somewhere or something like that, because I imagine there is a very big difference in the way you're received by some,
totally.
I don't know. I'm trying to think of like a restaurant manager, mm-hmm. like a, I don't know, like someone at, if you call Verizon, or if you're like at a store, mm-hmm. you know, something like that.
Definitely. Like I've had a couple instances where once we were at a Black Lives Matter protest mm-hmm. and the police showed up and they started like grabbing people, and she and I were both like, we need to leave, because like mm-hmm. they're not gonna grab her, they're gonna grab me, and yeah. I'm just not trying to do
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And we were in a situation a couple years ago where we got pulled over in a car, we were in an Uber, and it was me, my friend who's a black man, and my wife, and my friend who's his now wife, who's white. Mm-hmm. And so, and the driver had like a low cap on. He was white, but he kind of looked like we were in Miami. It was yeah. in Florida. It was like 1 o'clock in the morning. It was very scary. And I had to tell my wife, who likes to pop off sometimes, like yeah. she can pitch a fit. I was like, do not say anything, because yeah. you have two black people in this car
yeah.
and they're not going to receive it well from you. And who knows?
Yeah.
So like those are conversations that we have, like where it's like, she does pitch a fit mm-hmm. and sometimes she'll choose to be like, I'm going to go say something because I can throw a fit and you yeah. can't. But then sometimes I'm like, okay, you're throwing a fit is actually going to hurt both of us.
Right.
Just because I'm here.
Just yeah. by association. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. yeah. Yeah. That's definitely something to be like fully aware of. But I do think that that's like, that is such an interesting element of privilege that I've had to like figure out on my own, is like, oh, the fact that I'm even considering saying no to a cop or no to a security guard, or like I've in the way that I'm allowed to just sort of sail through those mm-hmm. situations.
Yeah.
Like I walked past a checkpoint one time at the subway, because you know, sometimes they do the cops are like, when they check bags, and a cop flagged me down and I said no, and I just kept walking.
Yeah.
And then I thought about it later that day, because I was in a fucking hurry.
Yeah.
I thought about it later that day, and I'm like, that would have not gone.
It would not have. It would have gone the wrong way.
The only reason I got away with that is because I'm white. You would
have been in cuffs. Yeah.
Like, absolutely.
I get infuriated. Like, I didn't go to the Women's March because like the way it started, I was like, I don't feel, mm-hmm. I was like, this isn't really my, I was like, I'm going to let the white people do this one.
Yeah.
And I saw someone on Instagram at the Women's March, a white woman, and she was standing on top of a cop car, like holding a sign and all this stuff. And I was like, that made me angry.
Yeah.
Because I was like, that was such, an ignorant display of privilege. Like she didn't realize that she was actually behaving as part of the problem in yeah. that sure. moment, because her performative allyship like veered so far out of control that she was now doing something that was like putting the people that were around her mm-hmm. in a bad spot. And like, so like, it was just like not realizing that like, I'm so white and female that like I can stand on a cop yeah. car, but yeah. none of these undocumented people that are participating, black right. person, yeah. like that's not an option.
Literally yeah. anyone who isn't white and
that's
female
not
in
a
that
good
moment.
Use of yeah. your privilege.
Right.
Plus
right.
that makes the march then seem like it's chaotic and a riot and all this stuff. You
yeah.
know, like, yeah, yeah. It's just not,
it was problematic smart. How much people in the march were patting themselves on the back for how there were no arrests. At the mark,
yeah. I'm and it's like that's not because of your
it's
behavior.
Not of right. you.
That's yeah. it's because you're white, and it's like yeah. that is a problem with your thinking, because yeah. then you think that the people get arrested at black protests
deserve it.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And that was so infuriating.
It's, yeah,
it's, but it's illuminating.
So, it yeah. is. Yeah.
Sure.
It truly is. And like, I really make myself, I go out of my way to like have those difficult conversations with friends and even acquaintances.
Yeah.
To be like, because I know that they're
That's
trying
kind of
their
you.
Best.
That's very kind of you.
And I'm like, I'm going to point you to the problem mm-hmm. because you don't know.
Yeah.
And it's, you are well-intentioned.
Yeah.
But intent doesn't equal outcome. And here's where you're a little
yeah.
bit off the mark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I imagine that takes a lot of emotional energy to
totally.
To sort of you know, guide a horse to water kind of thing. Like, I can't hold your hand through this entire process, you know, and you shouldn't, and you don't have to, you know, like that's, yeah. Like what, like kind of sort of finding that area that you're comfortable with of how much do I need to, how much emotional energy do I need to spend right now? Yeah, I imagine that's like kind of a process of finding your comfort spot with that. But yeah, the Women's March did really illustrate some, because I think another thing that specifically white women don't acknowledge enough is how much our distress, how much damage a distressed white woman can cause to anybody she wants.
Yeah.
Not just like, and it's never, like white women don't display distress in a in an innocent way ever. It's never innocent. They're always trying to get someone in trouble. And I think that we, and I use like sort of the royal we as a white woman, even though I'm not a, even though I am sort of marginalized a little, like I still have a ton of privilege. I'm not, but white women's tears are such a fucking weapon and they have been throughout history. And I that's probably the one thing that I wish I could.
I mean, it's gotten men hung.
Yes.
It's
gotten Emmett Till.
Till was brutally murdered. And that is still
that
a story.
Woman was not telling the truth.
No, she admitted she, after a long life that she lived, she conveniently towards the end of her life.
Oops.
I was lying. Yeah. Like, and that's, And I that's one thing that I do appreciate about the internet and about Twitter and about how things do go viral is that all of a sudden these women who are calling the cops on people are basically
getting
like
shamed.
A joke, like are being humiliated online. And I think humiliation and shame are an important tool in that way. Yeah, I just, oh my God.
I have a couple women that I follow on Instagram that do this thing where they like record men who catcall them, and like catcalling is awful and a bad thing, but it's the same problem I had with that video that went viral a couple years ago where it's like all the men in the video were men of color.
Yeah.
And I had to have a difficult conversation with a friend who had like, who was like yelling at a man who had catcalled her and recording it, and he was Latino, I believe, and like I was like, that's a misuse of your privilege. Sometimes you have to weigh the like pros and cons, and that's where intersectionality comes in. And that's when it starts to be those tough conversations with yourself where it's like, I have to relinquish my privilege even when it is uncomfortable for me.
Yeah.
Because you, him catcalling you is going to cause like a certain amount of damage to your psyche. Mm-hmm. You screaming at him in the middle of 72nd Street and saying he did something bad to you might cause more damage to that man than the damage that he caused to you catcalling. So you have to do that tricky math sometimes of deciding, am I going to use my privilege as a weapon against another a marginalized person, even though I'm a marginalized person in the situation?
Especially if it's possible that cops could become involved, because I don't think that, and it's taken, and full disclosure, I come from a family of police officers. So I was raised in this, first of all, in a very white, obviously, environment. Not only that, but to believe that cops were always righteous in what they did, because my dad and my grandpa and my cousin and my fucking uncle and everybody. And to unlearn that, and now I live on the other end of the spectrum where I'm like, I don't trust any of you motherfuckers. I like absolutely despise them. But like, you have to understand that if you're even in the proximity of police, and if they could possibly become involved in something, that could be a death sentence for someone.
For somebody.
Somebody who doesn't look like me.
Yes.
Like, and it is, they are, and white people, specifically white women who weaponize the cops, I just wish, there has to be a punishment
for
that.
And it should be. And because the thing is, some of them, they do know that and they do it anyway. And it's like, just because someone is bad, annoying, breaking the law, doesn't make them deserve to be executed.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is a real possibility. And
shitty people can be shitty and still not deserve to die.
Your annoyance, like the cut. I forgot who it was. I wish I remembered who wrote this. Someone wrote, it was a tweet or a piece or something where basically they're saying like, the police are not your customer service line.
They
aren't to white people and white women.
This is where I go back to the thing about white people being nosy. Mm-hmm. It's just like, mind your own business. Like, if you're,
mind your fucking business.
You're not an extension of law enforcement. So unless you see someone that's about to like harm somebody, like,
I don't
like,
give a shit.
Like, harm cause, you're not harming them by being around them.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. I can't even imagine. For me to call the police, it would have to be a pretty bad thing happening. But like, you, unless someone is active, like that whole break, well, they were breaking the law, like law abiding, because law abiding is code for white. Mm-hmm. When someone says like, well, law abiding citizen,
that's a
dog whistle. So someone breaking the law, I don't give a fuck if someone's, I don't care if you're smoking crack. I don't care if you're just like, as long as you're not actively hurting a person.
If I called the cops every time that I saw someone smoking crack in New York, let me tell you.
Yeah. Or be on the phone all the time. Like, you know, whatever. Who fucking cares? Just let people live. Like, I really wish that that was something, because I think that that's an element of white privilege that the well-intended, I more want to like reach out to like well-intended white people who just don't fully grasp these things.
Yeah.
Of like, here's what the police mean to you and I, and here's what the police
mean
to other people. But yeah, that was like a big, that's been a huge element of my unlearning process of the last like really since I've been in New York, is that now I'm, because of privilege, in a position where I do pull out my phone if I see, it happened the other day, I was in Harlem and going to a friend's house, and like there were people on the street, you know, it's like summer, it's loud, it's everyone's outside, it was a bunch of families outside in a Latin community playing dominoes and having fun, and like there was a bunch of shit, and all of a sudden cop cars start coming in from either direction, and I thought, oh, this is, and I literally pulled out my phone.
I was gonna say,
and I started recording. Mm-hmm. I had my finger sort of hovering over the button, but like I stood there like this, and I got up as close as I comfortably could to the cops and just stood there. And they glared at me, but they didn't say anything to me.
Yeah.
Because I wanted them to know I'm here watching you. Like, yeah. I feel like those are the things that we can do to extend, to like use that privilege.
Yeah.
And just be like, I'm just here. I'm watching.
Yeah.
Like, I will record. Because that literally my instinct now, if I see police interacting with anyone, is to record it.
Absolutely.
Which, just a plug for a past guest,
Elsa Wave.
Yeah. She does cop watch training.
Oh, cool.
So you can hire her if you want to organize a workshop or a class about that. And she's really good at that. And
well, I like what she said, where she says, I don't want allies. I want comrades and accomplices.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
That's important too. You have to be willing to like get in a little trouble, because
if you haven't listened to that episode,
it's negligible.
Yeah.
Listen to the allies episode with Elsa.
Yeah.
If you're a new listener,
it was great.
Go back.
Mm-hmm.
She's a gem. All right. We need to,
have we veered too far off topic?
A little bit. We need to wrap it up.
But it does.
Interracial relationships.
In relationships though, that is an interesting part that I've never experienced, in that of having that balance of like who gets to do the thing in public, like which roles we each kind of take. And I think in queer relationships, there's an element of that, I think, especially in relationships where one person is a little more masculine than the other, or like, I don't know. There's different ways of looking at that, but that is an interesting element of an interracial relationship that I don't have to consider because I live in a privileged, you know, in a privileged space.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think beyond just being friends with people of different races and different cultures, being in a relationship with someone of a different race or a different culture definitely, I mean, I know for me, like, forced me at an even deeper level to, like, you know, the ordering drinks thing was never something that I would think about, like, with a friend. But if you're dating someone and, you're so much more like attuned to the emotions and everything else that person is going through. So recognizing it and then seeing what your role can be in the situation.
And there's something about like, obviously a friendship versus a relationship where it's like,
it's very,
you
different.
Love your friends, but like you love this person, you know, and all of a sudden you're like deeply connected to every single interaction that they have,
right?
You know,
and also even going further than that, it's like, so my wife loves me, and so she has a vested interest in like Black lives because of me, but also because she's part of a Black family now, and like I'm part of a Jewish family now,
so
it's not that like we live in a Black household, and she has Black parents-in-law and sisters and cousins and all that stuff. So it becomes much more of a high-stakes situation in so many ways.
Yeah, and that's probably something that can only really be, you can only get so far until you're in a relationship with someone. And, you know, that's good. That's important.
Yeah.
All right. Do we have any listener letters for this episode?
We do. We have a listener question. I recently came out after being in a 5-year relationship with a dude. All right. I'm telling you, we've been getting so many listener messages about leaving husbands, breaking up with boyfriends.
I have more friends than I can count on my hand that have left their husbands for women.
I know. Yay. I'm telling you. In the last few years, I've noticed that. That's like, it's a revolution, but
it's evolution.
Yeah, we get our share of emails that are like, this podcast.
I was listening to this specific episode and broke up with my boyfriend.
Wow. Yeah, they should all read the book "Dear John, I Love Jane." It's a great book. Ooh. It's a short, essays about women that were in hetero relationships and discovered like either later in life or in long term relationships that they were into women. It's a really great book.
That's awesome.
That's amazing. That's a great recommendation. Okay, I came out recently after a 5-year relationship with a dude. I was seeing this girl for about a month. Oh wait. Let me go back and say the subject line was girls are confusing. we met on Bumble and I asked her out for a date immediately and she said yes. We went out a few times and things got sort of intense, of course. She told me last night that she wasn't looking for a relationship, but she's still messaging me wanting to hang out. Why is she being this way? What is the point of still talking to me if she doesn't want a date and we are clearly on different wavelengths? I guess my question is, what should I do? Be done with it and get back to dating or continue to try to be friends with her?
Don't do the lesbians and your friendships where you like someone or you love someone. You can't just be friends with them if they don't return that. It's going to eventually create problems.
Yeah, if you're both on the same page, like I know that I have exes who went on dates with women and then neither of them were really feeling it and then they actually formed a friendship. And that's normal.
That's normal. But not like I'm in love with this person. This person told me no. So now we're friends is even a level playing field.
No. Yeah. And the fact that you met on Bumble, you met on something that is a pretext for dating.
Exactly.
You know, that's not, I think you should cut your ties with this one.
Think that this person has to sort of put themselves back into the position of like, okay, what is dating like? And this new dating situation is like pretty typical,
whether it
is with a man or a woman.
Yes.
And like, that's a relearning process if you've been in a relationship for
5 years. Yeah.
So you have to adjust back to the dynamic of being kind of disposable to people in a way, like, being like, they've got other people in the mix. You've got other people in the mix. Like, this woman may be like your only focus, but unfortunately you're not hers.
Yeah.
Because she's sort of dating around and like you're used to, like I had to tell a friend that like, when you're used to having, a spouse or a long-term person, you cannot comfortably date someone that is used to dating around because you're looking for a spouse, whether you mean to or not. Like, you're looking for she's looking for that 5-year feeling.
Yeah.
And that other woman is looking for a date.
Yes. Yeah.
And so they're not on the same, they're not on the same page.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's normal, unfortunately, for things to feel very intense, very fast with women.
Yes.
That's a common thing. And then you might think, wait, I thought we were almost in love.
I thought you were my girlfriend now because we get along. And that's like the only.
Yeah.
Like,
and it's
you
just
know.
Not that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's also, you also should not take any personal offense to someone not being that into you.
No.
It's not an indictment of you.
It just means it's not right.
Yeah.
It's a lot of matches aren't right. And it's definitely not right if you're both not into each other the same amount. Do not waste your time on someone who is not as into you as you are into them. That is the biggest mistake.
You should both be obsessed with each other.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or and you will be on this, like you will know when you are mutually obsessed with someone, you will understand. There will be no like guesswork.
Yeah.
I definitely went through that once in college where I was really into this woman because she said yes to going on a date with me. I thought that she was maybe just as into me and we had a great first date and it was awesome. But then, you know, she was kind of dating around and had someone else that she was more interested in.
Yeah.
And I kept waiting for her to come around and be like, oh, maybe if I just like,
yeah, you're going
to
wait forever.
Yeah.
It's not happening.
If we don't come around.
No. Yeah. And if they do, it's not for a good reason.
No,
it's
sure.
because they're bored or someone else rejected them
bored.
Or they want attention and they know they can get it from you.
It's a sucky reality, but it is also reality and it will save you a lot of headache if you're just like, oh, not the one. Next.
I would, for this listener, I would honestly be like, I would personally kind of cut bait and be like, yeah, absolutely. I'm not. Because I promise you that we'll never go in a direction that you want it to, and that's frustrating and completely unnecessary for someone you met on Bumble. Like, yeah. It's not... plenty of people out there.
You should save up your money and go to London and meet up with Diking Out listeners there, because yeah. They are cute, smart ladies. Yeah, so.
Great.
All right, Lauren, how can people follow you on social media?
At Miss LAS on Instagram and Twitter.
Yay. And you can follow us at Diking Out on everything. You can give monies to us on Patreon if you're inclined. Patreon.com/Diking Out. And thanks for diking out with us this week. Out with us next week.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts, with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.